You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 22nd of April 2024 on Monaco Radio. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up on today's programme.
It provides for greater accountability over Ukraine aid. It forces an endgame strategy for the Ukraine war. It includes a loan instrument of this foreign aid to Ukraine and the Repo Act to ensure that Russian assets pay for part of the bill.
House Speaker Mike Johnson's about-face means Ukraine finally gets additional U.S. funding and Russia could see its assets seized in the process. We'll look at how Vladimir Putin might respond. Then from one ongoing conflict to a future one. We'll pivot to the Philippines, where the U.S. is launching a series of military drills in the South China Sea. And then from a future conflict to a simmering one, we'll hear a former U.S. ambassador to Kosovo about why reaching peace with Serbia is proving difficult. And finally, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, back from a trip to Anguilla in the Caribbean, that's where the valley is here in studio for a newspaper roundup. Bring us a touch of lightness, will you, Faye?
I will, Chris, I promise. But some shade as well, because we also discussed the protest against Gustavo Petro in Colombia and Anguilla's airport expansion.
All of that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Chermak. With a polarizing political debate continuing in the U.S. in recent months, Russia would have been forgiven for thinking that Washington had all but given up on supporting Ukraine. Instead, the House's passage of a $60 billion bill for Ukraine over the weekend has boosted morale in Kyiv and left Russia fuming. Not to mention that the U.S. also passed a separate bill allowing the Biden administration to seize Russian assets. Well, joining me now is Jenny Mathers, Senior Lecturer in International Politics at Aberystwyth University. Jenny, thanks very much for coming on the show. Russia has already responded predictably, I suppose, to this package, warning of a humiliating fiasco for the West. But how damaging is this in reality for Russia's ground campaign?
Well, I think given the fact that Russia had hoped to have pretty much a clear field and a free hand in Ukraine. You know, Russia had hoped that the stalemate in Congress in the U.S. would continue through the election and maybe into January and beyond, you know, that Ukraine just wouldn't get any more American aid and so would be able to dictate the pace and the timing of its you know, ongoing aggression there. And I think this at least has made Russia realize that it's not going to be quite so uncontested. The Ukrainians are going to have much more capability of protecting themselves, much more ability to fight back. So it's not going to be the walkover that the Russians had hoped.
And what is the state of Russia's war effort, if you could step back a little on that? I mean, the focus has been so much at the moment on Ukraine's struggles because of this funding debate, but also its struggles with conscription, ammunition. But Russia isn't finding this easy either, is it?
No, it's proving to be a huge strain and a huge burden both on the Russian economy and on Russian society. So we've already had the September 2022 partial mobilization, so-called, of 300,000 reservists. It's pretty clear that Russia needs even more troops. The way that it fights this war, it's very wasteful. But Putin hasn't wanted to announce a new round of mobilization. So there's a pressure right there. So there's tension in terms of how to get enough soldiers to continue the war in the way that Russia fights it. What Russia has been able to do on the economic side is actually because the state controls so much industry and is able to, move resources around, pretty much as it wishes. It's put a lot of effort into defense production. It's estimated that something like 7.5% of its GDP is now going on defense in the armed forces. They've introduced 12-hour shifts in defense factories. Workers don't really have the option of turning down longer shifts if they want to keep working, if they want to keep employed. The Dmitry Medvedev, who's the secretary of the Security Council, has threatened criminal action if, enterprises fail to deliver on state contracts for defense. So the state is using a lot of pressure, but at the same time, you know, there are questions about how long this can continue because, you know, obviously they're putting a lot of money into defense. They're not able to put so much into shoring up infrastructure, for example. We've seen some real damaging floods and other things which have demonstrated how crumbling some of the infrastructure is. So, you know, there's big questions about how long Russia can carry on with this effort.
Well, and what is the answer to that, if you will? I mean, Vladimir Putin presumably even now would still want to just kind of wait this out, wouldn't he, knowing that this might be, you know, the last tranche of funding from the United States? Or does this really quite, you know, crucially change the game for what Russia's thinking?
I think a lot of it depends upon how quickly Ukraine gets the resources from the U.S. And is able to use them, but also how well Ukraine is able to build up its own defense industry, how much the Europeans are able to come in and step up their efforts. So there's a lot of moving parts to this. And certainly Putin is playing a long game, and he's not one to make very decisive decisions very often. He often prefers to sit back and see how things develop and then take advantage of opportunities. So my guess is that he'll continue to keep the pressure on in Ukraine, you know, throw everything he can at the war. But, you know, those stresses and strains are eating away at society and they're eating away at the economy. So, you know, it's not a game that Russia is going to be enjoying playing, certainly not in the short to medium term.
Well, and Jenny, I did want to ask you about the Russian assets aspect of this as well. What is your sense of whether the West really will at some point seize Russia's frozen assets in the West, something that has been controversial up until this point? And how might Russia respond if they do?
So it has been controversial, and now the U.S. seems to be moving more in that direction. European nations are very much divided in terms of which ones are interested in moving in that direction, which ones aren't. Germany, for example, quite reluctant so far to go down that path. It raises all kinds of legal questions. It raises questions about how likely other states are going to be to invest their funds in North America, particularly, and also in Europe. So it raises longer term issues. It looks much more likely, frankly, that this will happen in at least some fashion, partly because it's included in this bill that's just been passed in the House. And there's a lot of appetite in the U.S. to try and make Russia pay in some way for all of its damage. Now, Russia has even, you know, yesterday and today has said, right, it's going to respond certainly with legal challenges, try and tie things up and slow them down as much as possible, both, you know, in as many countries as they possibly can, and that they would also provide or pass legislation which is similar and seize Western assets in Russia. So they're not going to just sit back and take it. They're certainly going to try and promote their own sort of tit-for-tat responses.
And just finally, Jenny, whether it's the Russian assets being seized or the simple matter of, you know, funding Ukraine by the US and Europe, do you have any sense of whether this will impact some of Russia's allies, China in particular, which, you know, reportedly has to some degree backed Russia's military effort? Will this kind of thing prompt them to support Russia more, or perhaps could it go the other way and have, you know, countries like China saying, well, if the West is resolved and putting money into this, it's time for us to step out?
Well, certainly the U.S. has been trying to put more and more pressure on China to get them to reduce or even halt the level of support that they're giving to Russian industry, because they're supplying Russia with lots of spare parts and bits and pieces that they need to produce for their defense spending. So, you know, the U.S. is saying, well, look, you know, China could be under sanction in the future if they carry on with this. You know, it's not going to be beneficial to you, because at the moment, China is really benefiting economically a great deal from this war. They're buying cheap Russian energy. They are, you know, selling lots to Russia. Their economic coffers are overfilling with Russian rubles. But the question is, you know, how long will China want to play this game? If it becomes too costly politically and potentially economically, they might decide to pull back. You know, Russia is definitely indebted to China in lots of different ways. Russia is clearly the suppliant nation here. It's the weaker one. China is calling the shots. So it's really up to China to decide, you know, what is going to be its most beneficial position out of this. At the moment, sitting on the sidelines, raking in the money is doing quite well for it. But, you know, the cost could rise, especially if the U.S. really gets serious about, you know, imposing sanctions on China.
Interesting how much China has benefited. Thank you very much, Jenny. That was Jenny Mathers. Now here's Mariella Bevan with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he would fight against sanctions being imposed on any Israeli military units for alleged rights violations, after media reports said Washington was planning such a step. Meanwhile, the head of Israeli military intelligence, Major General Aharon Haliva, has resigned. Haliva said last year he accepted responsibility for the intelligence failures that allowed the Hamas-led attack on Israel on October 7th. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will be in neighbouring Iraq today, with water, oil and regional security issues expected to top the agenda. His long-awaited visit is the first by a Turkish leader since 2011. And work is set to begin today on a $12 billion high-speed passenger rail line between Las Vegas and the Los Angeles area. Brightline West, whose sister company already operates a fast train between Miami and Orlando in Florida, aims to lay 351 kilometres of new track, with officials projecting millions of ticket buyers will be boarding trains by 2028. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Mariella. Now, another aspect of the foreign aid package approved by the US House of Representatives over the weekend was the provision of additional funding to allies in the Indo-Pacific region aimed at countering China. That passage comes as in the Philippines, an annual set of military drills with the United States are getting underway this week. The exercises include maritime drills that involve retaking islands in the South China Sea, claimed by China and its neighbours. Well, joining me now is Richard Heyderian, an academic and columnist for the Philippine Daily Inquirer. Richard, always good to have you on the show. We have spoken about U.S.-Philippine military drills at various points in the past. What sets these ones apart?
Well, it looks like every day is, or rather every year is more special, because last year we already had the biggest ever. Up to 17,000 troops participated in the exercises, majority of them from America. President Marcos Jr. himself oversaw the exercises. The United Kingdom, for the first time, had sent an observer to the exercises. But this year, we're keeping more or less at the same size, around 16,000 troops, but there are going to be more participant observers, including from fellow Southeast Asian countries like Thailand and Singapore. But the difference are on multiple levels. First of all, it's the location of the exercises. Some of the exercises are going to happen for the first time outside of the Philippines' 12 nautical miles territorial sea in the South China Sea. So that is a direct challenge to China's expansive claims across the area under the so-called nine-dash line, which was, of course, invalidated by international court back in 2016. But even more is the other exercise in the northern Philippine province of Cagayan, which is close to Taiwan. And in both of those exercises, essentially the Philippines and U.S. are preparing for amphibious warfare and island defense warfare. So they don't have to name China, but clearly they're preparing for a war scenario. The other thing is the type of weapons that are being sent. So also this year, we're seeing the deployment of HIMARS, a very advanced American missile launcher, but also Typhoon, which is also a newly developed American mid-range missile launcher systems. And this shows that America is trying to also flex its muscle and remind China that it has options and it has allies that may be open to hosting more and more advanced weapon systems, including the Philippines, which, by the way, has granted America more and more basing access across its northern and western bases. So put it together, you can see why this year is even more special than last.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Richard, the way you describe it there, it really does feel like a direct, not attack, but sort of approach to China, that these military exercises in particular are looking at the South China Sea, what China is doing there. I mean, how is China itself likely to respond to this?
Oh, as usual, China, not, you know, too dissimilar from Russia or other authoritarian powers who are not happy with American exercises, raised, you know, alarm bells. It warned the Philippines against playing with fire. It raised concerns about the deployment of some of these very advanced American weapon systems, such as the Typhoon system. But the reality is that the agent provocateur is not the Philippines or the United States. It's China that is threatening Taiwan. It's China that is bullying the Philippines. And, you know, in the recent incident of water cannoning, multiple Philippine naval servicemen were injured. So the Philippines is trying to remind the Chinese that, yes, on one-on-one basis, of course, China is way more powerful than the Philippines, but that the Philippines is not alone. It has many options. I didn't mention a while ago, France is also deploying some warships to the drills, but they will indirectly participate, not directly with the United States and the Philippines, but they will have some patrol in the area. The Australians and Japanese are also going to participate in some of these exercises. sizes. So this is what you call the American integrated deterrence strategy. This is about deterrence. This is not about provoking China. But China being China, of course, they want to keep a very imbalanced balance of power in the region so that they can dominate their smaller neighbors. So the Philippines has to stand its ground.
So the U.S. is one aspect of this, but also, as you mentioned there, some of these other countries that are involved also in the region is quite interesting. Australia is involved in this for the first time. Japan is also involved, as you mentioned. Japan and the Philippines also held a sort of trilateral summit with Joe Biden earlier this month. I mean, what do you make of all of that? Is this really, I suppose, trying to present this united front right now within, not only with the U.S., but also the Asia-Pacific region as a whole?
To be fair, President Marcos Jr., right after the historic JAFUS, Japan-Philippine-U.S. trilateral meeting in the White House, made it clear that he doesn't want to escalate tensions. He's not going to give Americans additional basing access in the Philippines, and that he's open to engagement to China, but on terms that are, you know, mutually beneficial, on terms whereby the Philippines is not an extreme disadvantage. And the Philippines also doesn't want to be over-dependent on the United States, and it understands that the U.S. has many obligations around the world. The Ukraine war is ongoing. Tensions in the Middle East can get out of control at any moment, as we saw over the past week. So it understands that the U.S. alone cannot hold the ground, hold the line. So the Philippines is also reaching out to other countries. It's exploring purchase of submarines from France or Spain. Australia has a status of forces agreement already with the Philippines, so they want to expand further their bilateral annual exercises. And then interestingly, the Japanese also are exploring their own version of a visiting forces agreement style with the Philippines, a reciprocal access agreement. And from my understanding, the Philippines wants the United Kingdom to also have a similar kind of agreement with the Philippines in the next year or so. So the reality is that, you know, after 6 years of Duterte presidency, where the Philippines was extremely subservient to China, when the Philippines, frankly, had very limited leverage on its own, now it's a catch-up time. So it's natural that China is going to react because it's used to a Philippines that is more or less a pushover. But the Philippines under Marcos Jr. is no longer in that position.
Just finally, Richard, speaking of this U.S. House of Representatives vote on foreign aid, that did include aid to the Indo-Pacific region as well. Much of that was focused on Taiwan, but I do wonder how that has been covered in the Philippines, what kind of signal that funding sent.
Right. I mean, the Philippines' foreign military financing under this new funding will increase from around $100 million to around $500 million annually. So we're looking at around 2.5 billion pesos, dollars, over the next few years. This is definitely an improvement. Historically, this is a huge amount, but I think the devil is in the details. I think the Philippines wants to see whether this could be sustained into, a Trump 2 administration, how bipartisan this is, but more importantly, whether the Philippines will finally have access to some of the more advanced weapon system that, you know, forget about Israel or some of the more key U.S. allies. I mean, even countries like Pakistan or Jordan have had better access to advanced American weapon systems based on grant or very favorable deals. And for some reason, the Philippines was taken for granted for a long time. So it's really a question of how the Philippines will leverage this new, more assertive American bipartisan foreign policy approach to China and other authoritarian superpowers. So it's an improvement. The Philippines is, I think, very, very happy about where things are going. But it has still a long way to go before matching the magnitude of challenge that China represents.
Richard, thank you very much for joining us. That was Richard Heydarian. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. You are back with The Briefing on Monocle Radio. I'm Chris Chermak. Later today, the UN Security Council will bear witness to a face-off between the leaders of Serbia and Kosovo. President Vucic and Prime Minister Kurti will both address the council in New York, as a peace deal between the two neighbors that once looked so close has collapsed and the two leaders accuse each other of stoking tensions. At the recent Delphi Economic Forum, Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke with Philip Kosnet, former U.S. ambassador to Kosovo, about the state of negotiations with Serbia. Andrew began by asking if Kosovo's current status is the best it can hope to achieve.
Well, I don't think the status quo in Kosovo and the Western Balkans in general is sustainable. What I mean by that is that the European Union and key member states and the United States have put a lot of energy and thought into trying to advance reconciliation between Kosovo and Serbia to the benefit of the region for years now. I mean, both the Trump administration and the Biden administration actually paid quite a lot of attention to this. And one of my messages to people in Kosovo is that this level of interest is not going to exist indefinitely. I actually think that the biggest challenge that Kosovo and Serbia face is complacency. For their own reasons, in their own way, neither state really feels a compelling need to reach a comprehensive solution to the Kosovo-Serbia problem. I think that Serbia has been quite successful in playing the European Union off against Russia, and Kosovars in their way, because they're so pro-American. I mean, so loyal to the United States, even when we don't deserve it. It's hard for them to imagine a time when the U.S. won't maintain its current high levels of economic and political support. Now, I'm not saying that the U.S. should or could abandon Kosovo. I think that our diplomatic and political support to Kosovo is important to the United States as well as to the region, and I think that will continue. But I don't think the level of economic support will. And in addition to governmental economic support, Kosovo gets something like 15 to 20% of its GDP from remittances from the diaspora. That won't last forever. I mean, you know, time and again, we've seen the immigrant generation will send a lot of money home, wherever home is, but their children will not. So I think that it's incumbent upon Kosovo to build its economic ties in the region, because one important element of Kosovo's economic development has to be stronger trade relations with all of its neighbors, including Serbia.
We'll talk about some of the other neighbors shortly, but in terms of the key relationship there between Kosovo and Serbia, do you think there isn't realistically an upper limit on how far that's ever going to go, the reconciliation you mentioned? Or is it imaginable that one day we will see Vucic and Kurti or their successors collecting their Nobel Peace Prize together and Serbia recognizing Kosovo's right to exist?
Well, their successors maybe, or their successors' successors. I don't want to say it's impossible. I think it's easier to imagine a modus vivendi, a working relationship, rather than Serbia rewriting its constitution and formally recognizing Kosovo and so on. I think that sort of progress is attainable, but it's going to require the European Union and the United States and other European stakeholders, you know, to let these people know the clock is ticking and patience is limited.
Well, we are sitting in the territory of one of those European stakeholders, and Greece, along with Romania, Moldova, Slovakia and Ukraine, still do not recognize Kosovo. Would it help if any or all of them got off the fence?
I think that's important. I think it would be very helpful if it's five EU member states don't recognize Kosovo, if they would do so. And they all have their own reasons. But I think doing that would help to establish that Kosovo is a real country, it's sustainable, and none of the stakeholders, and in particular Serbia and Kosovo, should not waste any more time, you know, fighting this diplomatic battle of recognition. We should just accept that reality. There are countries, they're non-recognizers, Greece is one of them, that have built up their economic and quietly their diplomatic ties with Kosovo, and that's fine. But I do think that formal recognition would be an important step.
I mean, do you think it's also an important step in averting the prospect of actual open conflict again in the Balkans, which is not something that ever goes entirely away and may not ever go entirely away? And we have seen Kosovo and Serbia a couple of times in quite recent years sort of walk up to that line and stare at each other menacingly across it. It's not completely implausible as an outcome, is it?
It's not impossible. I think it is quite unlikely. I think it is... It has been useful for some of the players to create a sense of drama, sure, so that they can then take credit for stepping back from the brink. I mean, that's an old game and a familiar one, and frankly, I don't think it impresses anybody very much. I think that it is important for the NATO KFOR, the Kosovo force, to maintain a presence in Kosovo. And that's one of the few areas that most people in Kosovo and Serbia seem to agree on. I mean, for their own reasons, they think that KFOR is important to maintain. It supports the safety of all the communities in Kosovo, including ethnic minority communities. So in sum, I think there is, I don't worry a lot about open warfare between Serbia and Kosovo. But I do think that it will be useful if we could just move away from this nonsense, stop playing these games, and focus on economic incentives. In general, I believe in carrots more than sticks. They both have their uses. Generally, people don't mind being fed carrots. They don't like being hit in the mouth with a stick. And even if sticks have short-term value, you know, they tend to create resentment that can last for a long time.
That was the former U.S. Ambassador Philip Cosnett in conversation with Andrew Muller. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle Radio. And finally, on today's show, it's time to take a look at some of the stories hitting the headlines in the Americas. We're joined by Monocle's senior correspondent, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, fresh off a trip to the Caribbean, back in the studio with us. Good afternoon, Faye.
Good afternoon. Good to be here, although...
Yes. Is it really?
Well, yes. I'm missing the sunshine. It's quite hard leaving a Caribbean island, 28 degrees, and come back to very cold London.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we'll get to one of your stories from the Caribbean a little bit later. But before we get to some of those cheerier stories, we do start in Colombia. Today, protests. We usually talk about protests in Brazil, but we're looking at Colombia today.
I think the ones in Colombia, they are more relevant. They happened yesterday, Chris, and it's been the main story from France 24 to El Tiempo. So basically, there were quite a hefty number of people. It's predicted a quarter of a million of people went to the streets in Colombia from cities like Bogota, and they were protesting against President Gustavo Petro's economic and social reforms. And just to give you an example, what people are protesting against. I think Petro's plan for the health service of Colombia is to nationalize it. But I think a lot of doctors are against, because at the moment, I think, from what I can understand, in Colombia, the private companies, they are very much, they are the larger kind of percentage of the health services in Colombia. So he wants to change that. I have a feeling it's not going to be easy. And another one, that he's got an ambitious peace plan. And, you know, peace plans in Colombia... Mm. Are always a tricky subject.
They sort of move the needle forward always, but yeah, getting to the end is tricky.
Exactly. And, you know, some people say that perhaps there are too many concessions to the armed groups as well. Mm. So it's been very much divided. And I have to say, hasn't been a good start for Petro. It's a shame, because he's the first leftist leader in Colombia to be elected, in fact.
Well, it is interesting how, frankly, in a lot of Latin America, isn't it, it sort of goes back and forth, and leaders on both ends tend to be sort of perhaps too extreme, and then you'll, you know, have protests from their people, whether it's Argentina on the other end right now, sort of from the far right, but then Petro on the sort of further left.
And I have to say, Petro, he wants to organize a pro-Petro march for the 1st of May. Let's see how many people he'll manage to gather on the streets.
Let's see what he succeeds with that. Always a little harder to do a pro than an anti-protest.
Exactly.
Well, let's move on to another story. Another place that you visited on your trip, you went to Miami as well, and you brought us a story about Florida's real estate.
Yes, that story came out a few days ago on Bloomberg, but I think it's remarkable, Chris. So basically, 7 out of the 10 priciest neighborhoods in the U.S. are in Florida. That's a remarkable number. There are quite a few from Miami Beach, where I was staying. You know, you have Rivo Alto Island, among many others. But just for context, here in February 2020, last time, 4 years ago, a little bit before pandemic, there were 6 out of the 10 neighborhoods were from California. So it's a little bit of a fall from grace from California.
Which we have seen in the pandemic, to be honest, was part of it. California has fallen off, and New York, for that matter, which is also at the top of those lists.
Absolutely. And listen, Chris, I'm sure there are a lot of political reasons. I'm sure we're talking about tax here, but let's not forget about the Sunshine Act. I mean, I don't know.
It's all about the sunshine at the end of the day, isn't it?
I was a bit of a Miami skeptical, but I have to say, it is fun when you have kind of a frozen drink in hand and the sun is hitting 28 degrees.
It is fun. I mean, I enjoyed it being there for Donald Trump's arraignment. I mean, that was sort of the politics in it, but then it was a very fun place to be at the same time. Also, the sort of Cuban-American community and the Hispanic communities there. I mean, yes.
It's fun. It's colorful. It's a good... And things are happening there. And just for people to know, the most expensive neighborhood is Gable States in Coral Gables, which is practically in Miami.
Coral Gables, yes, not too far.
Not too far.
A little suburb in the area. Well, let's move on to one other story, because we are going to head to the Caribbean and Anguilla, where you just spent a week. They have this really, really tiny airport that's about to get a little bit larger?
A little bit larger. I think quite a lot larger. So Clayton J. Lloyd International Airport. And it's interesting, Chris, because the construction for this new kind of terminal and parking lot started on the 15th of April when I was there. So I was there for this historical moment.
Watched the trucks arrive. Exactly.
I mean, they're a lot of trucks, a lot of construction work there. And it's interesting because it's such a small island. I think there's about 15,000 residents and it's very peaceful. It's all very quiet. But I have a feeling from, you know, reading articles or newspapers that this could be kind of the next it island. I hate this expression. I don't know why I said it. And the name of the airport is quite interesting. Clayton J. Lloyd International Airport. He was the island's first pilot. And he basically was the first man in Anguilla to own an airplane as well. So it's quite interesting because I had no idea who. I said, oh, is he a governor from Anguilla, a very important figure? But no, he is kind of this remarkable guy who kind
of... I guess back in those days, if you wanted to fly, you had to own your own airplane.
Exactly. So... And you know who else? I didn't meet him, unfortunately, but he's a very popular figure in Anguilla. It's Banky Banks. He's known as the Anguillan Bob Dylan. He's got like his own reggae bar, and he's known all across the Caribbean as well.
Banky Banks. Might he appear on Monocle Radio's playlist one of these days?
Yes.
Thank you very much. That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And that's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was George Ruskin and our studio manager was Mariella Bevan. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Chris Chermak. Goodbye and thanks for listening.